Jeff Verhoeven, Rudy Blair for Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet590.ca. And how fitting our show is called Top Turnbuckle, Rudy, because the guy that we have on the line right now made part of his living eating top turnbuckles. His new book, Animal, is available just about everywhere. We have George the Animal Steele on the line. George, who knew you could talk?
Hey!
George, thanks so much for doing this. How are you?
You. let me tell you something. There's two people using this body. You might be better off to talk to Jim Myers.
Jim Myers? Absolutely, we can talk to Jim Myers. Jim, first things first.
Hey! Yeah. Hey, over here. Yes, how you doing?
We're doing excellent. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm finally out of the cage. I've been caged with this animal for
I gotta ask, 50 years. Is the tongue green right now? Just curious.
The tattoo wore off.
Jim, like, first things first, let's talk about the book. I mean, you've had such a long storied history in wrestling, but when you delve into the book and you start off in your early life, you've really had an uphill fight for most of your life.
Well, the book is, you know, wrestling is really what it's about, I guess, but it's also more about overcoming so many different challenges. And it has been a wild run. As I look back at it, as you're writing a book, you start looking back at your life. Some of it started making a little bit of sense, but not a whole lot, to be honest with you. It's just been crazy. And people ask me, well, why did you decide to write a book? And a lot of the guys in our business wrote the books while they were still active. My career, this is my swan song. This is, thank you very much, folks. Goodbye. I'm out of here. So that's what the book is all about, really. And I want to say this right up front. What I did learn is looking at your life through a rearview mirror when you're writing a book, you really start to understand a lot of the things that happened. I mean, the learning disability at the beginning, being sent to the gym in high school because they didn't know what to do with me. They didn't know what dyslexia was yet. Graduating from high school with my wife of 58 years as my wife at that time. Going to Michigan State University with a challenge. But they're figuring out, they still don't know what dyslexic is, but they realized that I had a little bit of basic intelligence and a great memory. And so I got through school there on a football scholarship, but never played it down. Go figure. And I was a pretty good football player, but I was always in trouble because of my learning and my character and my knees. But that's not a cop-out. I could have played. Mm-hmm. And then ending up teaching high school when I had such a struggle in high school, and then never being a wrestling fan, but ending up and wrestling under a mask so I could afford to feed my family. I was making $4,300 a year teaching, and so I needed a part-time job. I met Bert Ruby, and I come back, told my wife I was going to go through the tubes from Detroit to Windsor, Ontario, to learn how to wrestle. And she told me, you'll never make enough money, which was 25 cents a toll, to go back and forth to Canada. So she didn't have a lot of confidence in it. And for my life to pop out the way it did on a part-time basis at the very top rung of the wrestling business for so many years as a part-time guy, I mean, it's just crazy. And I was, you know, teaching and coaching, and I left a whole lot of money on the table every year when I went back to coach and teach, but that was my other love. I have nothing but great respect for the wrestling business. It's been so good to me and my family, and it's just gone through the roof. Now it's a $1 billion industry. Who would have thought? When I got in the wrestling business, it was black and white TV. Come on. Now the production's through the roof. Does that pretty much cover it, I guess?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's such an accomplishment that, you know, back when you were growing up, to deal with dyslexia, which, I mean, it's before my time, but I imagine it probably wasn't a known thing, to deal with that through your entire life, and then with the end result being a book, I think that just speaks volumes on the success that you've had in life.
Well, like I said, I looked at my life through the rearview mirror, and what I did learn is that before I ever knew him, God was in control of my life. There's no other way you can explain this, and I didn't accept my faith until 2002 is when I accepted my faith, but then everything started falling in line for me. It's just, it's wild, it's crazy, and it's really strengthened my faith and my faith, and it gives me an opportunity to do a pretty good testimony. But I don't want to puke on people like so many people with faith do. I just open the door and let them, you know, we'll go wherever they want to go. Because before I knew the Lord, if somebody asked me where I was at with Jesus, my response was, what's it to you? So there we are.
I got to ask you, how did you balance your character as George the Animal Steel from who you really were? Because a lot of people will now remember the WWE version of what we've known before your retirement on that typical character. But back when I used to watch you growing up, I mean, you were one of the most feared wrestlers, you know, out there. And the fact, of course, and not really speaking and the grunts and the things that you would do, how did you balance that out in from scaring the heck out of people to being a family man?
Well, you mentioned, I can't think of his name right
Abdullah
now.
Abdullah the Butcher?
Abdullah the Butcher. I think Abdullah the Butcher, the Sheik, the old Sheik, and George the Animal Steel all came from the same stable, Bert Ruby. Mm-hmm. And so we had kind of the same background. And here, you know, this is how I say, God, this is how that worked. And this is wild. I'm on TV all over the Canada, all over the Northeast, but Detroit had a different teacher wrestling program, so they never saw me in Detroit or where I taught. They never saw me as George the Animal Steel. They only saw me wrestling with a mask on as a student until about 84. Anyhow, so the students didn't know what I was doing. In fact, a kid would move in from the Northeast or from Canada or somewhere like that, and they'd bring in a program or a magazine, and they'd say, that's you. And they had four or five kids with them because they'd been talking about it. So they'd confront me, and I'd look at it and say, really? Do you think I'm that ugly? And that changed the subject real quick. So, and then with the family thing, as you know, so many wrestlers have struggled with their families and died so young and so on and so forth. I think by keeping one foot in the wrestling business and one foot in the teaching and family business, that it kept me a little bit more stable in a lot of different ways, possibly, if you can call what I did stable. I don't know if you can or not. But it was just a fun thing. And a lot of people ask me, well, how could you go from the wildest, most vicious heel in the history of the WWF to that lovable cartoon character, George the Animal Steel, schmitten over Elizabeth? And it was pretty simple because the business was changing. When Hulk Hogan became our champion and everything was structured differently, and we were selling, I like to say, lunch buckets and action figures more than we were selling wrestling, and that lovable character could sell some lunch buckets and action figures much better than the old George the Animal Steel, the wild, vicious heel, could do. So it just fit. It was perfect timing for me.
But the course that you took, and correct me if I'm wrong, because, again, I'm going by from what I remember when I was younger, your character wasn't so much about titles. It was more almost like a hitman back then. So it wasn't like you were making money by holding on to a title and being champion in an organization. It was more or less you were brought in to hurt people, bottom line.
I was brought in to challenge the champion for year after year after year. It started off with Bruno Sammartino. It went to Pedro Morales. Then there was a little bit of a jump in there with Bruno back in, you know, Bruno Sammartino back in town. Then they jumped a little bit to a heel champion. With that was very short with the superstar Billy Graham, who was fantastic. But the WWF was afraid of riots with a heel as the champion, so then they switched it back to Bobby Backlund. And there I am again with another run. And I think this is pretty factual that I'm the only fellow that wrestled all the champions up to Hulk Hogan. I don't think another heel did that. But they brought me in to wrestle the champions every summer, and that was really my deal. And a lot of people say, well, how many belts did you win? And I said, you know what? I wore Sansa belt. I didn't need belts to hold my pants up.
You know, you mentioned about, and I'm going to jump in, you mentioned about riots. Didn't you start a riot? Well, I can't remember where it was, but all I remember is seeing pictures of chairs flying all over the place, and you were the one who caused it.
You know what? Back then, I had so many riots, first of all, because I thought it was cool. And then Bert Ruby and later on Mr. McMahon explained to me that when I say Mr. McMahon, I'm talking about Vince Jr.'s dad.
Okay.
The heat was great, but riots was bad for business. So I got to the point where I could bring the people to a point where they wanted to kill me and then bring it back down so we didn't have a riot. So I only had one situation, I think that was in 1975, and it's in the book, where I was trying to get out of Madison Square Gardens and they had it surrounded. I couldn't. And they finally put me in a cab, and the people chased us in a cab. They tried to tip it over. They got locked in behind a truck. They went to kill me. Finally, the truck moved after it stalled, and we went down the road, and they were chasing us down 8th Avenue and jumping over hoods of cars as we got past things. So it was wild. But I had a riot with my good friend Killer Kowalski. We were partners. He got mad at me because of the riot in Atlantic City.
That's the one.
It was crazy. It was wild. And I thought that was cool. We were hiding in the back because they were tearing up the locker room looking for us, and the cops come in and saved us.
Holy. That's crazy.
I had a riot when I was a student in Grand Rapids, and this is the funniest thing ever. I'm trying to get up. Our locker room's up behind a stage, so I'm trying to get up the stairs, and Gary Hart was my manager at the time. We were fighting the people, and this cop is standing there. He told this one guy, "What are you doing? What are you doing? You know this is all a show." And the fella responded, "I know it's a show, but two on one's not fair anyplace." I got to chuckle out of that.
Oh, boy. I think one of the things that really speaks volumes about your career in pro wrestling is, especially when you look at wrestling now and how much emphasis on the promo there is, and guys aren't successful unless they can go out there and speak for 5 minutes on length. And you made such a successful career by just uttering maybe 5 words total.
Let me tell you a funny story there, too. When I first went to Pittsburgh, and that's when I became George Steele, because it was a Steele city and I didn't want to use my real name. So I suggested Steele, and that's how George was evolved only 46 years ago. So that part of my body is only 46 years old. But going from there to what was your question again?
I was just talking about how guys today, and even, you know, the Hulk Hogan era, they need to be able to talk in order to be successful. And that's so much emphasis is put on the promo. But you didn't need that. You were so successful and so loved and so popular. When
I first went to the Pittsburgh, that's why I started this story, I did my own interviews, and I was pretty articulate.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went to the Northeast in the WWF the following year, 1968, I did my own interviews again because I was the only heel that did not have a manager because that was just a summertime deal. They had no idea how things were going to get over. So I went in, they called me back the next summer because we sold out every place, and we did it again. And then the third summer, they said, "Well, we're going to give you a manager because when you're not here, we need somebody to keep your name alive because you're a hot item for us." So that's when I got a manager. I still did all my own talking for a year or two. And then Vince Jr. come in and was doing the interviews. And I think it might have been with the Grand Wizard, or it might have been Captain Lou. He said to me, Vince said, "You're making too much sense for an animal." And that kind of irritated me because I like doing interviews. Mm-hmm. And So he put the mic back in my face, and I went, and he said, "Yes, that's what we want." So I didn't like it, but they put the handcuff on me. But it really worked out great because I was blessed with some great managers that did the talking, and it just let me loose to go wild. But that, again, just how things happen. Looking back, how would that happen? Who would come up with that idea? Crazy.
Yeah.
Green tongue. Why would you have a green tongue?
That was my next question.
And everybody asked it. I had a couple of drinks. I didn't want the promoters to know it, so I threw a Clorox in my mouth, and the place went nuts. We'd just gone to color TV from black and white TV. So the people thought their TVs were screwed up. They were calling in, you know, what's going on with my channel? And it was my tongue was green. About 3 months later, I thought, well, I'm going to do that green tongue thing again now for my own entertainment. The first time it was by accident. The second time it's for my own personal entertainment. The place went nuts again. So from then on, I had the very best breath in all of wrestling.
And the turnbuckles, how did that start?
Black and white TV, Pittsburgh. They used to give us, in TV with our promotion, we made our money in the arenas, not like it is now. And they used to give away different token gifts to get people to come to the show. It's a studio wrestling. We had about maybe 300 people in there. Black and white TV, they had plywood around the outside with white faces painted on it to make it look like we had more people. And then they, this particular show, they give away the old satin couch pillows from the 60s. Packed real tight, and we got 300 people with 300 pillows, and some lady got mad and threw her pillow at me. What am I going to do with a pillow? If I sit on it, it's going to be boring. If I throw it back, I'm going to get hit with 300 of them. So I bite it, it explodes, I put it over, you know, I start throwing the stuff in the air, and it sticks in my body here like I'm the abominable snowman. And then I take the pillow and put it over my opponent's head and start choking him. And when I pulled it off, he was blue because the stuffing was lighter than air, and every time he took a breath, it was going down in his lungs. It almost killed him. So I go to the dressing room, they're all laughing, and somebody said, boy, if you get to throw a pillow at you every time, you'd really have something. And Tony Pugliese, Bruno's cousin, I think he's from it there in by Niagara Falls, at a restaurant in Canada there in Niagara Falls, mm-hmm. laughed and said, yeah, maybe you could eat the turnbuckles. And everybody laughed. About 2 weeks later, I'm wrestling with Jay Strongbow. And it's hard to have a flat match with Jay Strongbow because he was tremendous talent. Mm. But we were having the flattest match of all time. And so I looked over at the turnbuckle and I thought, well, I wonder. And I went over and took a bite out of it. Broke easy. I rubbed that in his face, ran his head into the corner. And all of a sudden, from a flat match, we had a riot. So from then I was known for a green tongue, eating turnbuckles, and not knowing a clue about wrestling.
What would you say is your greatest feud? Because for me, as somebody who's been a wrestling fan, watching you and Bruno Sammartino going at it, I mean, two of the hairiest guys, of course, in wrestling, but also the fact that you were supposed to be his last match. In fact, if I'm correct, you were supposed to be his retirement match, too.
Exactly right. And that was by his choice, because Lee had great matches. The business is a lot different today. Back then, we knew who was going to win. It was predetermined. But we didn't know how we were going to get there, so from the beginning of the match, even the entrance into the ring later on, to the end of the match, was pretty much real. Now, because it's TV and everything, it's a little bit more choreographed, but it's the same business, honestly. And I get a lot of questions about, well, what do you think about the business today? And a lot of the old-timers my age, they knock it. I don't. And it was always a business. It's a billion-dollar-year business. I think it's the best production in all of television. In fact, I think the NFL, the NBA, and that the All-Star game, the baseball, they picked up a lot of Vince's ideas on fireworks and production. So, you know, he's just taken it to another level. The WrestleManias, who would have ever thought that WrestleMania 1, which was then on a shirt, you know, no money at all, and then WrestleMania 2, when we went to three different venues on a satellite, if one of those would have failed, the WWF would have been out of business. Mm-hmm. So Vince was a risk taker. And when he made money, he put it back into the business. So, you know, I give him nothing but credit. A lot of guys knock him for this or that, but what a businessman. Come on. And look at the talent today. They're great athletes. They're much better than what we were. Now, the difference is, in your old school, you'll know what I'm saying. We were a heck of a lot tougher.
Yes.
And I think that's the difference, really.
Absolutely. And that's the other thing I want to talk about, because a lot of the fans today never had the chance that I had, was going to Maple Leaf Gardens. And because you mentioned, of course, Tony Cannonball Parisi, I mean, there were so many great wrestlers that went through that time, and you wrestled there. What was it like wrestling back then at Maple Leaf Gardens?
And that's what's so neat about it. The old Maple Leaf Gardens was not one of these big venues that they have today. It was rustic. It was fantastic. You felt the hockey in there. You felt the wrestling. They used to take us out to the ring on a platform so that people couldn't get to you. You just felt the energy in that building. The same with the old Boston Gardens. And a lot of the old arenas, they were so special. Now, they're not as beautiful as these arenas are today. And if you remember, you were probably paying $5 or $6 for a ticket. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, the tickets are through the roof. It's a totally different age, totally different business. But I love the old arenas. I love the black and white TV. When I go out and I do personal appearances, the guys have real colorful photos. I have them also. But I also have a couple of black and whites that I love, because that's what I'm all about.
Rudy's a little bit older than me, and he remembers more of the...
A little bit older.
He remembers the Madison Square Garden one-hour draw with Bruno Sammartino. For me, my George the Animal Steel memories are when I think the world fell in love with you, was when you developed the crush on Elizabeth.
Nice.
Yeah, absolutely. But we hear so many stories, and I think it's Hulk Hogan that tells them the most, about Randy Savage and how sort of protective he was of Elizabeth and almost borderline jealous of the attention that he would get. What was that like, getting into sort of that storyline angle of you being in love with her and kidnapping her, et cetera?
I was there before Hulk. I went through all that before Randy really got a little easier with it. When I went through it with him, it was just really tough, because he was very, very ultra-jealous, over-the-top jealous, and we'd be doing interviews, and he would, you know, they're live interviews, so he'd do something, and just as he was leaving the locker room to go to do the interview, I'd say to him, well, you know, I got a daughter older than Elizabeth, just relax and have fun with this here. And he just as he'd go without, but I'm an old man and I've had a heck of a run with some of these young broads around here. He would just pipe her up. And I wanted that the way I wanted him. I wanted him just fired up because it made it for a better show. What you saw with that jealousy was real. And it came through as real. And that's what made the whole run so great. It was a 2.5-year marriage with Randy and Elizabeth. We wrestled almost every night. And he was the new era coming in. The first time we wrestled, he had about 5 pages written out of how we were going to have a match. Mm-hmm. And I just told you earlier, everything I did was called in the ring. Mm-hmm. Totally did. So he knew it was coming together with the old. I read what he had, wrinkled it up, the first page, threw it away, and then did that, he was getting hot, and then I threw the second, third, fourth, fifth page away. And I said, just listen to me, kid, and we'll have a great match. Well, he was absolutely hostile at that point. And I covered this all in the book. I got a whole chapter on Randy Savage, and the other part of it is how he was so professional about things, and he was the new era coming in. He was where they're at now. Mm-hmm. He was just I wrestled his dad when he was a little boy, like 12, 13 years old, so yep. I knew Randy a long time, Angelo Papo. And my last run that has any memory to it was with Randy Savage, and I really believe that's what got him over the top, become a superstar, and later on the WWE champion, and wrestling with Hulk Hogan and all that stuff. So I was a stepping stone for him, and not only that, he was great for my retirement. So it was a great fit.
We're talking with Jim Myers, a.k.a. George the Animal Steel. His book, Animal, is available wherever books are sold. And Jim, transitioning from Randy Savage and Elizabeth into what many consider the greatest match of all time, which you had a big role in, WrestleMania 3, 93,000 in Michigan, your hometown, and Ricky Steamboat versus Randy Savage. Again, many think that's the greatest match of all time, and you had such a big role in it.
Well, we set that up between because of my run with Randy and Elizabeth, and Steamboat got involved in it, and it was just a fantastic match. But I was sitting there at ringside just steaming because I did not want to be a manager in that match. Mm. Sure, I had an opportunity to stand there and look across the ring and see Elizabeth. And this match that I had heard so much talk about how it was going to be done, being done in front of me, and it was a fantastic match. But I'm 15 miles from my home. I'm at the twilight of my career. Do you think I want to be a manager in the biggest show ever? No, I wanted to wrestle somebody. And so I was a little bit upset with that. Again, my big deal was, okay, at 1, 2, 3, you push Randy. So at the right time, I push Randy, and we made Steamboat the Intercontinental Champion. And I still get a lot of residual paychecks from that.
Yeah, no kidding.
My high spot would have been better if I'd have been wrestling somebody else. But it's not bad just standing in the ring, looking across and seeing Elizabeth. It's not a bad job. The reason that I was smitten over Elizabeth, everybody asked me, was that your daughter? It was this or that. The only reason that I really was after Elizabeth, now, this is a tongue-in-cheek, naturally, is my wife don't do windows.
Sir, I got to ask you this, because I heard a story, and this has probably happened, and it's probably happened many times with you. There was a story that I heard that you were at the airport once, and this woman came over, and this is around this time during WrestleMania, and she went to speak to you like, you know, you were George the Animal Steel and couldn't speak. And she was like, you know, are you okay? You know, do you need anything? And you were like, madam, I am perfectly fine to get my own water. And she was in shock that you could actually speak. Did you do this a lot to a lot of people?
I did it occasionally for my own chuckle. often, let's say I'm sitting in a restaurant or a bar, and people didn't recognize me. They come up to buy me a drink. I just turn around and look at them. I never let anybody buy me a drink. And it was like, get out of here. I just stayed in character most of the time. But when I dropped it, it was always a funny thing. People today come up to me, and they look at me, and they'll say, are you who I think you are? But they don't want to say, are you George Steele? Because I realize what I look like. And they don't want to get somebody mad if it's not George Steele. So I always say, well, I don't really know what you're thinking. Well, did you ever wrestle? Yeah, I did wrestle. Was your name George? Yeah, George. Do you think of that ugly? And then I run off with it. We have fun with it, don't know. I walk down the beach, I get that all the time.
Do you think your character could work now? Because I know they've tried certain type of, you know, crazy characters, you know, like yours, like Abdul the Butcher's, like the Sheik, but it never really comes together. I mean, could it work now? And if it could, how would you develop a character like that for today?
I'm sure we could. With Vince is okay, and if that's the direction. Are you hearing me all right?
Yeah, hearing you great.
Okay. I had a buzz in, so I'm going to pick up the phone. I was doing a different system. Anyhow, it could be done. Actually, they've done George Steele in a couple of different ways. They did it with Mick Foley in The Sock.
Yep.
And they did it with, what's his name, with the head?
Oh, Al Snow.
Pardon?
Al Snow.
And those guys are pretty creative. The thing about it is, now this is going to sound very egotistical, but if you read my book, you know I'm not very smart. But the key is intelligence in that role. You can't overdo it. If you step over too far, it's lost. They had a guy in there that he was calling Eugene.
Yes.
And he was pretty decent, but he went too far with it. And it becomes a joke. The bottom line is, when I would take the mind, at the end of my career, I had that mind doll.
Yep.
And I would take him in and... he had Velcro on his hands, so he'd hang on the ropes. And during the match, he'd swing around a little bit, beat up my opponent. And then he would take the mind doll and kick it. When he kicked the mind doll, I acted like it was me. And when he's stomping it, I acted like it was me.
Mm-hmm.
And the people bought into that.
Yep.
But you're playing it on an edge now. You know what an edge you're on? And I honestly believe this, that Vince McMahon, to this day, learned a lot from watching that character play the edge, because they used to tell me, they didn't tell me what to do, they just say, go out and let's see how far you can go tonight. So I think, it was just how far can you go and keep it real. And that's the tough part. That's really hard. And you got to walk the edge. I used to have kids come up to me now, going into arenas and tell me, no chairs, don't get DQ. I'm talking about 4 and 5 year old kids. But they related to me. We lived across the street from the stadium where I coached for so many years. In fact, last year in October, they named it after me. That's pretty humbling.
Mm.
But kids in that neighborhood, while I was doing George Steele, would come, and the lovable George Steele would come to my door and call for George to come out and play.
Huh.
They thought it was one of them. We drove up one time. My wife was driving, and we drove up to an arena in California, and 4 or 5 kids, about 8, 9, 10 years old, come up, George, George. And my wife gets out, and we come around and get my bag out of the trunk, and they said, is that your mother? She said, that's gone far enough. So, yeah, I was like, and then after, I'd get beat. And this is when I was really doing the cartoon stuff. I would throw chairs in the ring. I'd throw a couple of the table in the ring. I'd throw the ring in the bell in the ring, the bell that rings in the ring. And I'd bring 4 or 5 kids in. One would be the announcer. One would be the bell ringer. And then the other one would be the referee. And the referee would hold my hand. The announcer would say, George, and I just got beat. I got disqualified for using a chair. George Steele's the winner. And I'd jump up and down like, yeah, thank you. And these little kids are all part of my thing. Then I'd go over and I'd tell them, eat, eat, eat. And have them eat a turnbuckle. They'd try. They couldn't. I'd eat one for them and give them the stuffing. I mean, I was one of them. I was one of the 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds.
That's awesome.
And it worked.
I there's a guy that we work with named Jazz Mangat, and I know he would be eternally disappointed if I didn't ask you about your role in Ed Wood and the transition into acting.
Yeah, that's another deal. I get this call from Tim Burton, worldwide, world-renowned director, mm-hmm. tells me I look like a movie star. So I mean, okay, now I'm telling me I look like a movie star. And so anyhow, then they told me, I went out and met him. He said, well, you're a little bit short for the part.
And so it looked like I wasn't going to get it, but they were looking really for somebody, a real lookalike. And so I did Tor Johnson. I researched the part after I got it, and I found out that this movie star, Tor Johnson, was the first guy to do monster movies without makeup. Hmm. And I look like him. I'm a movie star. Yeah. So it was really not, you know, the acting, and I get a lot of people talking about saying that I did a great job in it, but it was really not about the acting. It was about the look.
Mm.
And it's funny because I wasn't nervous. And when I first went on set, a couple of, you know, superstars were there, and they said, well, are you nervous? And Bill Murray was there. And he said, well, why would he be nervous? He's been acting his whole life.
Did you also do a commercial?
I did the first national commercial ever done with a wrestler that I know of anyhow. It was for Minolta Computers. Naturally, they failed later on. But, yeah, and I did it with Tony Randall. Then I did five or six others. I did one with Toyota. I did one with a Verner's Ginger Ale with a local in Detroit that's now gone national. And I did one that was just, in fact, you can find it on YouTube. It's really funny. Grant Hill, the basketball player.
Yep.
And, you know, and I'm from Detroit, but this was a national for, I can't even think of the shoe company now. It'll come to me probably. At my age, things blend in and out. Bill Lambier, the bad boy from Detroit, and we were going to make Grant Hill tougher. So the whole commercial was built around that, and it was just we did three of them. It was really good, and the shoe wasn't very good, so we were going to do another one, but the shoe flopped, so we didn't do another take on it. But it was I did about eight or nine commercials, actually.
We're speaking with Jim Myers, a.k.a. George the Animal Steel. We won't take up too much more of your time, but there's one story in particular from your book that I wanted to get into, and I know, I don't know if Rudy knows this or not, but when you were sort of coming up and you were in school in Michigan, you would go down to the gravel pits to work out, and you would see somebody else
in college.
In college, right. And you'd see somebody else working out who ended up becoming a pro wrestler.
Well, he was already a pro wrestler. I saw him on the other side of the pond there, and we'd wave to each other and so on and so forth. And he was an international superstar and one of the greatest heels in the history of the business. He lived in outside of East Lansing. I'm trying to think of the name of the town now. Williamston. Mm-hmm. I lived there, too. Williamston, Michigan. And we'd waved to each other. And then a few years later, once he came back to Detroit to promote and wrestle, it was Eddie Farhat, the original Sheik, mm-hmm. one of the greatest men in the history of the business. And we remembered each other from those college days. He was running and doing so on and swimming. I was running and running up and down hills. I didn't know how to swim, so I was limited in my workout. But we'd have weights out there, and we didn't know each other. It was across the pond, but we'd wave and boom, boom, boom. And later on, yeah, it was like, again, how did that happen?
Jim Myers, a.k.a. George the Animal Steel, his book Animals, available wherever books are sold. Jim, thanks so much for doing this. This has been a real treat for us.
Well, thank you for the time, and God bless you guys.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care.
God bless.